Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again. And as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio today is Anthony Oliveira. He is an academic and pop culture writer whose stuff you can find on his Twitter account at Mea Koopa. That's M-E-A Koopa, as in the bad guys from Mario. Anthony, welcome.
A little turtle. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to finally like.
By the way, congratulations on graduating.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Long, long, long time coming. It took forever, but finally done. When they put me in the ground, I'll still be a doctor. Thank God. Yeah. Thank you so much.
I don't know anyone who has graduated with a doctoral degree who was like, yeah, that was over in like a year. That was super fast and easy.
Yeah. They always take, they're like, a march through Ireland. It takes forever. Yeah. But I'm glad it's over with. And now God knows what comes next.
I don't know what comes next. I do know what's going to come in the next hour, hour and a half, which is that you and I are going to tell people things that we think they should do with their lives.
Right. I'm the least qualified person to do this. So I'm super excited. This is going to be great.
That is not true. You are enormously qualified in as much as I like you. And I think you're right about everything.
Oh, well, so, back at you. All right, we're going to kill this. You can feel it.
Yeah, this is going to be great. You can tell this is going to be a really heated episode where we really come at things from different angles and perspectives. But before we start getting into specific advice, I wanted to give everyone a general piece of advice, which is that I think walking out of a movie that you are not enjoying is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself. I recently did it, and I had such a good time, which is not to say, by the way, that you should go out of your way to see movies you think you will hate, because that's just, you know, wasting money. But every once in a while, you know, you take a swing and you miss, and you are finding yourself in the middle of a movie thinking, I have given this movie the fairest shake I can possibly give it, and I just wish I were anywhere else. And I just want you to know
that in case...
Oh, my gosh. So for me, it was the movie Three Billboards. And that's not to say that other people should walk out of that specific movie. I'm totally agnostic when it comes to what movie you should walk out of. But if you're just having a lousy time, and you're like, man, it's been an hour. I'm just not enjoying myself. Bail.
See, this is I think what we need is an etiquette for the walkout. Because John Cleese has that really good rule about when you're allowed to bail on a book, where it's like 100 pages minus your age. Because it's like, as you get older, you have less time to waste on a book. I think that's a good rule. We need a similar rule, I think, for movies. Because some movies, they're slow burn, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I liked Three Billboards, though. I kind of want to...
and that's the thing, is I'm not saying other people either shouldn't go see it or should walk out of it, but that was the choice that was right for me in that moment, and right. I'm very, very glad that I did.
What is the pleasure of it? Is it like the canceled plans pleasure?
It's something like that. This is probably advice that will only be helpful to some people. If you are already the kind of person who's like, yeah, I feel enormously comfortable leaving a movie if I'm not enjoying myself, why would you need to remind me that I should do that? What a silly thing to suggest. Then that advice is not for you. But for some of us, I think we will think, I paid, you know, $14 or whatever for this. I should see it through. It would be weird if I left. You know, I owe this movie something.
Do you go for the refund? Do you make that play?
No, not.
You don't.
No. I think a movie.
You commit. You make your purchase, but you are allowed to leave. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
My Catholic guilt is like overacted right now.
Well, I come from a long, long line of Protestants, so we never feel bad about anything. We just make decisions and then move.
You're allowed to do things to the text that I'm not allowed to do. I think that's the difference there.
Yeah, exactly. We're not in conversation with the text in the same way. Yeah. But it can be great. I think sometimes I know people who feel like they can't stop reading a book once they've started, or they can't walk out of a movie. And every once in a while, it is great. I walked out of Birdman. It was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, you know what? I don't want to hear another hour and a half of a drum solo. I'm good.
I think this needs to be a gift I learned to give myself. I'm going to try this new spiritual praxis.
You don't have to do it every time. I mean, save it for special occasions. But if you are just miserable, if you are just having the worst time and you don't think it's going to get better, you know, go hang out in the lobby.
I walked out of the Leighton Meester roommate movie. Was that what it was called? Where she was like a stalker?
Interesting. Yeah, it was like a remake kind of Single White Female.
Oh, yes. That's what it was doing. I had to leave. It was too much. And it takes a lot to get me to leave a theater.
I was going to say, and that kind of sounds right up your alley. It's Leighton Meester. It's a vague single white female remake. I mean, I sat through all of Swim Fans, so my tolerance for that kind of movie is pretty high.
That one, I think I couldn't have left that one. I'm a sucker for eye candy, so.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. Well, so now that everyone knows what kind of movies we have walked out of and can judge us accordingly, by the way, I'm sure there are people listening right now who are like, you walked out of Birdman? I'm never going to take your advice ever.
I really appreciate that the intro you've given me is like as a hater, just like I am here to hate things. That's good.
Yeah. This will absolutely be the theme of that episode. To that end, with the spirit of that conversation in mind, I want to tackle our first letter, which I did not give you in advance. I saw this late in the mailbag.
Curveball right away. Okay.
I saw it and I was just like, obviously we have to. This just like hits all the check boxes of like things that I love having an opinion about. just like rudeness, consideration for others, being in a relationship, not listening to somebody telling you their own experience. It's got it all. This letter has everything.
Okay.
The subject is breathing room. Dear Prudence, I'm 32 years old and was diagnosed with asthma when I was a small child. Mostly, my asthma is well controlled, and it's been 10 years since it's caused an ER visit. I met my husband 6 years ago, and we've been married for 3. He has a body spray that he rarely uses, think a few times a year. I can't be in the room or even enter the room after he has used the spray, or I risk having breathing problems. I have asked him not to use it. He has tried to compromise by using it in the bathroom with the fan on or right before we leave the house. The last time he used it, I unknowingly walked into the bathroom immediately afterwards, and it took days for me to feel better. I have brought it up twice, which has just resulted in arguments. He claims that he thought I was done using the bathroom and wouldn't enter the room until we returned a few hours later when the fumes would have cleared. I want him to get rid of the spray. He thinks that is unnecessary. Am I being unreasonable? I am considering throwing the spray out myself.
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. Okay. Are you going first?
Do we think the letter writer is being unreasonable?
I think anything that could result in I have been in the ER because of it is like, that is on the table for discussion. I don't understand. I don't think you throw out the spray without telling him. I think that you say, like, this is a poison that is in the house that can cause me to be hospitalized. I don't understand why he wants it. Like, what is it? what is his end game here?
No, and like, of course, my mind is going to, it's probably a terrible body spray that I object to personally on an aesthetic level. I am just giving him like the worst possible reading here. Yeah, it's weird to me that saying, hey, it took days for me to feel better resulted in an argument. Like, that's not something you argue about.
Yeah.
That's something where at the very least he would or should have said, I am so sorry. That was on me for making an assumption about what rooms of the house you were going to use. I should have told you and or at the very least, like, gone outside to apply it so that it would dissipate.
This is so bizarre. I mean, even just the word body spray gives you so many clues as to like it's not a cologne. It's a body. So it's like actively aerosol. Like, he actually has other options for this. Like, he can use he could use a beard oil. Like, there's lots of other, he could use a roll-on that's from the same company. Like, there's lots, if he's worried about smelling or if he's worried about smelling nice at an event, he has other options here. Also, like, if this is his partner, there's no one who's going to be in tighter quarters with him. That person should have like the deciding vote on what he smells like. That's
right.
Part of how this works, yeah. Right?
Yeah. I would say, letter writer, you have been fairly reasonable in not even saying, like, you've given him the freedom to use it. You're just asking for a very reasonable accommodation. And so I think that the follow-up conversation is just, look, if you're going to use this a couple of times a year, what I need from you is not to assume that you know what rooms in the house I'm going to use. I need you to let me know in advance. Just going in the bathroom and turning the fan on doesn't cut it. That's insufficient ventilation.
Right.
This is a health issue for me versus you have a number of options about putting on scented products. So, you know, one of these really does trump the other.
Yes. I don't think there's a compromise. There isn't a compromise to make about, like, you can compromise about what TV shows you're going to watch or what you're going to have for dinner. You're not going to compromise about my ability to breathe.
Like,
I don't,
right.
Lungs
can't not react to this, whereas he can apply it elsewhere or find a different scent delivery system.
Yeah. The problem here is that this is a straight man who doesn't know his other options. Like, he can get a roll-on. He can get a beard oil. Like, he could just not try to kill his partner like this.
I mean, in fairness, we don't know the letter writer's gender. It is a little hard to imagine that, you know, I understand where that assumption is coming from.
I think this might be a theme as we proceed, because I had some trouble parsing the gender dynamics of a lot of today's letters.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that comes up and that can be really interesting. But yeah, for this one, you know, the conversation is, look, my lungs can't rest on your assumptions, my dude.
Yes.
At the very least, even if it's only a couple of times a year, I still have asthma all the time, right? Like, even though this is only a couple of times a year, that's not the end of the compromise. So when you apply it, you know, first of all, I think you should look into something that is not aerosolized. If you absolutely must, you need to let me know before you do it. And you need to do it, frankly, outside. Go to the garage, you know, stand, you know, it's going to feel a little goofy, but like, go in the backyard, step outside.
Yeah.
Spritz it on, let it dissipate. You need to make sure that it is somewhere that I'm not going to walk into, and you need to tell me. I can't guess. Don't make the assumption. You need to tell me.
Yeah.
And if you can't do it, throw it away.
I don't need the night of a big event to also worry if I'm going to have an asthma attack, you know?
Right. Yeah. And
look at that. We're unanimous on the first one.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard not to be, right? Like, it's hard to read this and be like, well, you should just have different lungs. Like,
yeah.
Only
exactly.
One of you can change here. And
the one thing that does give me pause is the, like, should I just throw it out? You should not just throw it out. I don't know what your end game is there either. Like, eventually he's going to notice it's missing and the fight is going to be infinitely worse. So.
Right. Because that doesn't address the real problem.
Exactly.
I mean, I understand why you feel that way, but it wouldn't help.
Exactly.
If I thought it would help, but he could just go out and buy some more.
Right.
So the real issue is, like, he needs to grasp that this is about your health and that he needs to be, like, this is you're not asking a lot. Like, you're asking for a bare minimum level of consideration. It is
breathing. I mean,
not
it's
at all difficult
low
to
on
say
the hierarchy of needs. Yeah.
Right. And all you're saying is, hey, I need you to tell me when you're going to put on your body spray. That's not hard. He can do that. I have every faith in his ability to do that. So this next letter comes from a call I put out recently, which was I wanted to hear from people who were contemplating an open marriage, not because something was horribly, horribly amiss and they were hoping very much that it would fix their problems, but just because they thought it seemed like something that they would like to do. Because it seems like that's the best reason to try an open relationship is because you think it sounds like a good idea for you. And I feel like I generally hear from people who want to try it for other reasons. So the subject line of this letter is just opening a happy marriage. Dear Prudence, on the podcast, you recently complained that you never hear from otherwise happy couples that think open relationships sound like fun. Only people who are miserable and in unhappy marriages who think that opening the relationship might somehow help. So I decided to write in. My husband and I have been married for 3 years. We don't have any kids. And our relationship is great. We work really well as a team and we love each other a lot. We also think opening up the relationship could be fun, but haven't done it yet for fear of messing up what we have. It seems like it could open up a lot of opportunities for jealousy. We have the additional complication of both coming from conservative Christian backgrounds and getting married as young virgins. Neither of us are Christians anymore, and we've worked through a lot of the shame that our church has promoted around sex, but we've only ever been with each other. Additionally, I'm bisexual, but because of my church background and young marriage, I've never been with a woman. The pros would be having more sex with different people, and having the casual sex that neither of us experienced in college, we're only 25. The cons would be introducing potential conflict into our otherwise happy marriage. I would be curious about what your thoughts are. We don't know anyone in a happy open relationship, so we don't have models of it being successful.
Oh boy. All right.
Yeah.
I went first last time, so you got to go now.
You got it. So congratulations just on having a happy marriage and a partner that you can talk about things like this with. I think that that's really lovely. I can certainly start with a disclaimer that I have never been in an open marriage. So I am purely a supportive stranger who can point you in the direction of some resources. But I have no personal expertise and I don't want to make it sound like, oh, I definitely know the way that it's going to be great. Because you're absolutely right. I think the concerns and the goals that you have make a lot of sense. So you say that you don't know anyone in a happy open relationship. You have no models of what a successful open relationship would be. And I think that's probably the place to start, right?
Right.
There's no rush. It sounds like your main priority is to continue to prioritize your own marriage with one another. And I think that that's really good. I think that's a really good sign. So I think your first step should not be, let's find somebody for one or both of us to ask out or try to hook up with, but to investigate further into what can it look like. And the internet will be your friend. Books will be your friends. Investigate different models. Read different stories from various couples who have developed open relationships and kind of talk to each other about what sounds appealing about that. What sounds unpleasant? What sounds boring? What sounds painful? Just learn more before you dive into anything and talk extensively about, how do we want to communicate when it comes to stuff like jealousy? What kind of things would be fun and what kind of things would be just not for us? Find your models. Again, I think just Googling stuff like couples talking about open relationships. And I'm sure that, if anybody wants to write in with particular like websites or stories or books that they've found helpful, please do. But learn more before you try anything.
Yeah, I think that's the first step here. I should also disclaim by saying I have also never been in an open relationship. And I also, I understand particularly the letter writer's anxiety that because it's it's part of my personality matrix too, that the jealousy that seems inherent to this would also be a yellow flag, at least for me. But I should also say that I know actually quite a few people in very happy open relationships. And I think that the first thing about an open relationship is that there's very many different models for what it can look like. Like it can look like, you occasionally invite someone else into your relationship. It can look like, you can both pursue, different relationships as long as the other doesn't find out too many details. Like I know a lot of couples that are just sort of like, you don't disclose and that's fine. As long as they don't hear about it, it doesn't matter to them. Some people really want to talk about the people that they're seeing and they really want to get to know like what on the other person's adventure is like. Sometimes people have kinks that one partner is not into and they want to explore those kinks with somebody else. I think that beyond looking into what kind of models are available to you, there has to be a very clear discussion about what exactly is and is not on the table. Because I do think that you can be okay with some things and then suddenly not okay with something else. And I think it needs to be clear. That discussion needs to stay open, and the communication has to be very forthright about that sort of thing, I think. The other thing here is the concern the letter writer expresses that, well, what if this actually damages the relationship? I think that also needs to be a discussion that you have, is like, what if something does develop with somebody else? Is your marriage something that you are committed to no matter what? Or what if in this sort of exploration of yourself, they're sort of talking about their limited experience, her own experience of never having been with a woman. What if something, you discover something about yourself and you discover somebody you like more, that you have more feelings with, someone you want to explore more? You have to also have that discussion. Is the marriage the ultimate, or is this something that, in the case of something coming up, are you willing to then renegotiate the terms of your marriage?
Right. I think a lot of times people can carry this idea of a relationship is either monogamous or a free-for-all.
Right.
And if we are in an open relationship, it means that anyone and anything is kind of on the table, and we don't really ever get to pause or stop. And like, man, if all that comes out of this process is the two of you spend a lot of time talking about an open relationship and then deciding not to do it, that is a good outcome. Like, if you guys spend a lot of time researching, talking about your thoughts and feelings, and you just decide, gosh, there's just not a version of this where we feel like we could also prioritize and cherish each other, that is a great outcome. You learned more about one another and about yourselves, and you took care of each other. That's good. Mm-hmm. And if you guys try it for a little while and some things come up that you weren't anticipating, and you say, you know what, we're going to hit the pause button, and that ends up just being, you know, you decide we tried it and there wasn't a way that we could make it work. That's a good outcome, too. So please don't feel like you have to be like great at an open relationship, or that it has to work for you forever without ever morphing or changing or having limits or rules or boundaries. You can, whatever it looks like for you is a good outcome. And it, yeah, it is also funny because as I'm saying this, I'm like, boy, am I temperamentally unsuited for an open relationship.
I'm so much the same.
yeah, it's just not for me. It's no interest.
But I know lots of people who are very into it. And I mean, there's actually quite a thriving. There's apps, like in the same way that there are apps like Grindr, there's apps. One of them's, I think, called FetLife, where it's just like couples post together. They post very clearly, like, what are they into? What are they not into? What are the terms? What kind of person are they looking for? I know people who are interested in like being a special guest star in a marriage for a night or two and then going on their own way. I think that also is an important dimension to remember here, especially in a couple that is as less experienced about this sort of thing as this one is that keep in mind there is a third person here, and you have to also treat that person with respect, and you have to be clear
yes.
with that person about what the terms are and what you are and are not willing to put on the table here.
Yeah, I think that's so crucial to address. I think especially, not that there's anything in this letter that suggests that they're going to be like jerks, but I think just one thing that like I've certainly encountered in my own life as a bisexual person is the handful of times in my life that I've been on a dating app. Just sometimes there are a lot of messages from couples, especially heterosexual couples, especially married couples that have a lot of, you know, legal protections, social privilege, who can be really rude and aggressive
yep.
and just assume, hey, you're a bisexual person. I bet you would love to sleep with the both of us. And that's just not true. Like the fact that you would like to experience being with women is great. And you have the right to figure that out and to seek that out if that's what you're interested in. But please bear in mind that other queer women, bisexual, lesbian, queer, whatever, are not necessarily going to be into the idea of a threesome with you two or just dating you on the side while you're also married to a guy.
Right, exactly.
So I think one thing you should definitely think about is seeking out experience with other couples, people who are also in open relationships, people who are looking for very much what you are looking for, as opposed to going on a sort of standard dating site that's generally for single people looking for other single people and trying to find somebody there who wants to either date one or both of you or hook up with one or both of you. And to just be really polite and don't assume that every that necessarily just because somebody else is a bisexual woman, they are super into the idea of going out with you and your boyfriend. Because I think sometimes,
right?
I think sometimes couples that want to open stuff up make that assumption and it's rude.
Right. I think that, yeah, I think that the culture, as much as it's nice that these apps have emerged and that we are more willing to discuss these things, there is kind of like an Uberification of this like third party where it's like, you have all these privileges and now you want to have another part-time person. And I think it's important to remember that that is a person. That is not just a fetish object, but someone you can hurt. And someone you do, just by virtue of entering into, however casual this relationship is, you do have ethical obligations to that person and emotional ones too. Like you can't just treat somebody like an object unless that's exactly what they're into, right?
Right. Yeah. And to bear in mind, just because you two may be excited to explore an open relationship does not guarantee that the rest of the world will be as excited as you are.
Yes.
And that's fine, that's not a problem, that doesn't mean other people are letting you down or that you guys are bad people or anything like that. It just means what you're looking for is very specific. And if you don't, you know, if you strike out 20 times before you find another person or couple who is like, yeah, that sounds cool to me, that's not necessarily a problem. It might not be your favorite thing, but just like in any sort of dating, knowing what you want is great and helpful and clarifying, and it does not guarantee that other people will necessarily want the same thing and that is actually okay.
Exactly.
I would say that my last piece of advice on this would be probably just a good rule is to assume that for every new experience, you guys are going to have like a 3-to-1 ratio of talking to doing it. You know?
Yes. And I think that also, I mean, part of this could be just you're enjoying the fantasy of it, right? Like that is also a possibility that maybe the talking is itself performing the fantasy. And it's like, that is also okay. If your marriage is perfectly happy and you just want to think about these things, that's fine. Like just like, again, as long as you're communicating very clearly about it, I think that it is risky. I do think that. I mean, as we said, like, I can't imagine doing it myself, but that's constitutional. If you're, especially two people like this.
I mean, I also can't imagine sitting through Birdman again, but a lot of people really liked Birdman. Like, my experience is not universal.
Exactly. Yeah. And as long as you are honest with yourself as much as you can be, and as honest with your partner as you can be, and as honest with this third person as you can be, go for it. Why not?
Yeah. All right, I'm going to do one. I know we're spending a lot of time on this letter. I'm going to throw in one last thing. Don't feel like if jealousy comes up in a way that is painful and debilitating, that your job is to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody experiences jealousy in different ways, but by and large, people who are in open relationships are not just like magically free from the condition of jealousy. That can happen to anybody. And it can also be easy if you do get into being in an open relationship to save all the fun and exciting, sexy new energy for the people you are seeing outside of your primary relationship and letting your primary relationship be just like, oh, this is the person I share the bills with and take out the trash in such a way that leads you to stop investing in them. So, you know, be aware that that is something that might happen unless you are careful to make time for one another and to prioritize one another in your own way. And that also, if you get jealous in a way that doesn't feel sexy and fun, but in fact feels debilitating and painful, say it and ask for what you want. Like, don't feel like, oh, because we're trying an open relationship, it is now my job to be above jealousy and to never feel insecure or require reassurance, mm-hmm. or to say, I am actually not okay with this. Pay attention to it. Because if the jealousy outweighs the fun, then that's a good reason not to be in an open relationship.
Yep.
And that's why I am not in an open relationship.
Go ahead.
Oh, all right. Let's skip ahead to the next one.
I think we need to start fighting, like, actively.
All right. Well, then that means that one of us is going to have to say something about cat stealing. Because once again, I've been called upon.
Am I reading this one?
You are.
All right. Subject, did I steal a cat? Dear Prudence, so a month ago, a pretty calico cat began to follow me around after I petted and fed her. She was a skinny little thing and didn't have a collar. I led her into my apartment to see how she got along with my other cat. They got along splendidly. I named her and took her to a vet for a checkup. She wasn't microchipped and had been spayed and neutered. No one had called the local rescue society, missing a cat of her description. I paid to have her shots chipped and put a collar on her. I was moving in with my girlfriend at the same time, so I might not have been as diligent finding the old owners as I should, but I put it off as the cat didn't have any tags and there were no flyers in my neighborhood at that time. Now I have moved in with my girlfriend into a different neighborhood across town, but I still visit. Last time, I saw a lost pet flyer with a picture of my cat or close to it. Now I feel conflicted. My girlfriend says the cat is ours now, that she didn't have a collar or tags, and was being neglected. The cat has put on a healthy amount of weight since we got her and looks a lot better. My girlfriend says anyone who let their cat roam like that has to know they are playing the odds on their cat not coming home with cars, dogs, and the coyotes that come out at sunset. I still feel guilty, but I love my cat. And I don't want to give her up. am I going first on this one?
You tell me. You pick a side. Either you did steal a cat or you didn't, and I will argue the other.
You stole this cat. This is a stolen cat. That's my opinion. What's your take?
You didn't steal a cat.
Whoa,
this is
I
have to. We decided we're going to fight on this. This is
all
like
right,
being assigned sides in debate class.
All right. Well, okay. I think that the most telling statement in here is when the person says, my girlfriend says, anyone who lets their cat roam like that knows they're playing the odds of not coming home because of cars, dogs, and the coyotes. Like, you have just allied yourself with the coyotes. You are this force out there that has stolen this cat, that has disappeared it from someone who loved it. And I think that this question of like, well, was it being neglected or mistreated is secondary. You have taken someone's beloved pet, whether it was beloved or not. They want it back. Their posters are out. I think that the question of whether or not you should keep it is perhaps different than did you steal it, but you definitely stole it.
Right. Yes, that is the important thing, right? Because two things. One is a car did not hit this cat, a dog did not attack this cat, and a coyote didn't come for the cat. Right. It was a person who took it. So all of those things are red herrings, right? Like none of those things happened to the cat. You happened to the cat.
Yes.
And the other sort of question is, was the cat neglected or abused? And the open-ended part about that is we don't really know how long the cat was missing for. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's entirely possible that the cat went missing at a relatively healthy weight and then within a week or two lost a couple of pounds because, you know, they went from being a mostly indoor cat that got fed a couple times a day to a cat that was trying to fend for itself for the first time.
Right.
So it's not like a slam. You know, sometimes people will write in and they're like, my neighbor's cat is always wandering around, always miserable, clearly neglected. And this is a little more questionable.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't, there's not like a smoking gun of like, yes, they 100% were terrible cat owners.
Right. Yeah.
So I would say that absent pretty strong evidence, someone was neglecting or abusing their pet. They did try to look for their cat, right? Like,
yeah. And the fact that they didn't put up, I mean, this person also says that they didn't do their due diligence. I don't know quite what that means, but clearly you didn't try very hard to get this cat back to the person it belongs to. So and now that the posters are up, a cat or one that looks close to it, I mean, this person is trying, whether they didn't do it on the timeline you expected or not, they're trying to find the cat that you definitely have now stolen, right? So now, again, I think the question of do you now return it is a different one, but I do think by any metric, you have stolen this cat.
Right. And that doesn't mean you're like a horrible person. It's not like you did nothing, right? Like you did take the cat to the vet. You tried to see if it was microchipped. I don't know how old the cat is, right? You say it was a skinny little thing. It's possible that this cat was young enough and indoors, like, which is why you know, she might not have had a collar yet, and they might have been planning on getting her microchipped when she was slightly bigger, or getting a collar later. But at the time, we're like, this cat is indoors, the collar's not super important. And then one day, like, someone left a window open, and the cat jumped out and then got lost. Like, there's you just don't have the kind of certainty that would allow me to say, yep, that other person should not own this cat.
Right.
They have forfeited their right to pet ownership due to clear neglect and abuse. And the thing is, you know, you didn't know before. You tried. It's not that you were just like, hey, free cat, no big deal.
Uh-huh.
You tried. But now you have evidence that somebody out there is very sad about having lost their cat, and they're trying to find it.
So now what?
And I think you should call. I think you should call and say, hey, I believe I may have found your cat. You know, and let them know where and when you found the cat. And you can certainly ask, like, was this cat microchipped? It may be a different cat, right? They may be like, oh yeah, our cat was microchipped. And you're like, oh, it's just a cat that kind of looks like
right,
yours.
Right.
Best of luck, different cat.
Right.
But yeah, I think you got a call. I think
you
got a call. Yeah. I mean, frankly, if I found a cat that seems neglected, I would want to have it taken like good care of, but I would not be like, oh good, I want another cat. I've got one cat, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want more cats. So I wouldn't be wrestling with the part about, oh, I really want to keep this cat.
Right. But if you did really want to keep this cat?
I get it. You love the cat. Like, I feel for you. I don't think you're a jerk,
yeah.
But
this is the
question is not, do you love this cat? The question is, do you have sufficient reason to believe that a loving owner is sad at the loss of their cat? And I think the answer to that is yes. And
yeah.
When that's the only thing that matters.
Yeah, I think, yes, I do think part of me, as I was reading this, was like, well, what are the demands of the ethics versus the demands of love here? Like, are you allowed to violate your ethics if love is sufficient? And part of me is very uncertain. I think that ethically, you must absolutely call. You have
I feel
to
like
return
I have Soren
the cat
Kierkegaard
you stole.
On the show right now.
Yeah, exactly. But part of me is like, well, Augustine says, love and do what thou wilt. So I think that to the extent that your conscience will bother you, that is your own affair to decide. But you stole this cat, just so we're clear. You stole it.
Right. And like, it doesn't mean you're a monster. It's not like you snuck into someone's house and stole the cat. But like,
right.
Yes, the cat, you now know, is not, you know, the owner has not forfeited their right to this cat. And
yes.
The fact that your girlfriend is like, well, they must have let this cat go outdoors without a collar. And again, you don't know that. Their cat may very well have run outside.
Yeah.
Once when I was living in an apartment building, my cat, who's an indoors dude, got out, and he would sometimes like wander around the hall and then come back inside. And one afternoon he did not come back in, and I looked for him for 5 days. I put up posters, I called local like rescue shelters, and eventually one day I was walking around my hallways again looking for him, and I heard him from inside one of my neighbors.
Oh, no.
And I knocked on the door and I said, I'm so sorry, I think that I've heard my cat. And the woman was like, oh yeah, he wandered in here a couple of days ago, and she just sort of trailed off. Like, she had just 100%
stolen your cat.
Yeah, and
this
it
is
was
the thing.
Like,
you have to weigh the love you have for this cat against the potential suffering you are inflicting on another living human being who has lost
yeah.
their beloved friend, possibly. Maybe they are garbage. Maybe they did, like, neglect this cat. You have no way of determining that. There is a Schrodinger's cat problem here too.
Oh, I can't believe it took this long for us to do that.
No,
yeah.
But I do think that, yes, I do think what is casuistry here is that you are trying to dismiss the ethical here. You have stolen a cat. There is no, you were the coyote. You've taken this cat out of circulation.
You were the coyote. This is, ask a mystic. This is beautiful. You are not a bad person. You just, the thing in front of you, you have to do something that you don't want to do.
Right.
And I feel for you. And you had better believe that I like just went into that lady's house and was like, thanks for looking after my cat. I'll take it from here. Like, I very weirdly did not say, you kind of stole my cat, ma'am.
Right.
Because it was very confusing.
Pets are fascinating because they're loved ones and their property, right? And there's no way to reconcile
right.
those two things. And
well, that was the
both dimensions of that impinge in these sort of problems, right?
Right. They need to have like a find your iPhone thing on microchips for cats.
Yes.
Where you can just press a button. Because he was my cat. That's the crazy part, or the wild part, is my cat was microchipped and registered and had a collar with my phone number on the tag. Like nothing about him was difficult to track down. Also, I lived three doors away.
What was her end game like that?
I don't know that she had a plan. I really don't know that she had a plan. I moved out of there shortly thereafter. Now I live in a bigger place, and he gets to enjoy his old age, where all he wants to do is sit directly on my neck.
Right. Well, see, that's the thing. We need the technology either to absolutely find the cat, or to absolutely be able to tell who the cat prefers. Right. Like that's what we need, really.
All right. We need to move on.
Okay.
Is what we need to do. All right, so okay. We are ending on a slightly less fraught note. Would you please read our final letter?
Sure. So this one's subject is boyfriend's nickname. Dear Prudence, about 3 years ago, I met my boyfriend at a writer's workshop at the school where I was getting my master's degree. He's a great guy, and we're happy. The problem is a silly nickname my friends have given him in private that I haven't been able to shake. Here's what happened. At the workshop where we met, my future boyfriend asked permission to read a bit of erotic poetry to the group. I immediately texted some close friends and said, "Oh my God, this guy is going to read a poem about penises." Penis poem guy spread like wildfire in my group and quickly became what they refer to him as, despite the fact that I later, and here they say him, I don't know if it's him or them, despite the fact that I later assured him it was all in good taste and nothing like that ever happened again at the workshop. Some friends have dropped it, but I must admit my inability not to laugh has damped my perceived seriousness about the rest not using this name, always in private. What at this point can I do? Oh boy.
Yeah.
Am I going first on this one?
Please do.
Okay. I think that this letter is not good about recognizing the extent to which they are responsible for the situation. I also don't, I have a lot of red flags about the letter writer taking responsibility to the extent to which they created this problem. And I don't really understand why it's a problem except in themselves. The first thing that troubles me is like, if you're in a writer's workshop and someone says, "Would it be okay if I read this?" The response is not to then text a group of strangers about this person, which is already a betrayal of trust that you have now infinitely exacerbated by bringing that person into their lives. Like, you made somebody in a vulnerable moment into an object of fun and have now permanently exposed them as that object of fun and seem to be doing nothing to, like, ameliorate the situation. Like, all this would take is a conversation where you say, "Hey, I shouldn't have done that. Can we not call him that?" I don't understand how it's been 3 years and they're still calling him this. It's not a clever nickname.
I was going to say, I think the most astonishing part of this is, like, I can relate to gossiping or
right.
making fun of someone privately instead of saying something when you are asked. That's not a good quality in myself, but I find it relatable. What I cannot at all relate to is the idea that you still laugh at this 3 years later. It's not a 3 years funny joke.
No, it's not a 3 day funny joke.
No, it's barely 3 hours funny. I'm just amazed to think of your friends being like, "Hey, remember 3 years ago when your boyfriend wrote erotic poetry?" And you're like, "Yeah, that's hilarious." Still, like, you guys are not funny.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's unkind. I don't want to get too unkind in response, but like, I'm surprised that you are still cracking up at this.
Yeah. And I think that our sort of brusqueness about this is the fact that it's like, this is very low stakes. Like, the only problem here is that you are not addressing it. Like, why aren't you just saying, "Don't call him that"? Like, it wouldn't take much. The fact is that this person seems oddly still tickled by it, which I just find completely baffling.
And I'm not against dick jokes. I thought American Vandal was one of the greatest TV shows ever written.
It's not a funny dick joke.
No, it's not. It's literally just like, this guy wrote a poem about genitals. And it's like, yeah, people do that sometimes. Maybe it wasn't a great poem. Maybe it's not your favorite thing about him. But
he also, yeah. like, he was like workshopping it. He also like asked permission before reading it, which what kind of workshop is it where, like, this is the most out there thing somebody did, right?
Like, right. I feel like everybody who gets, I don't have a master's in writing workshops, but, like, I feel like all of us have written some pretty bad poetry about sex at some point, probably. Like, if you write poetry, if you are a writer, like, you've probably written something kind of embarrassing and goofy.
Yeah. And, like, why do you, your friends shouldn't even know it exists, which, again, like, it happens. You say something you shouldn't have said. You make a text you shouldn't have said. You didn't know this person was going to become a major figure in your life. Like, there's a degree to which certain boundaries were punctured, not with malice, but they were punctured. And now you have to kind of put the genie back in the box. And the simple way to do it is to say that, like, I shouldn't have texted that, or just, you don't even have to get into, like, some kind of self-flagellation. Just be like, hey, can we use his name? Like, they've known him for 3 years. Like, what is the problem here?
Right, right. Yeah, your problem has an easy solution, letter writer, which is, like, get the giggles out of your system. You have had 3 years to laugh at the one joke. Like, you're done.
Yeah.
It has run its course. And just say, hey, guys, this is my fault. I have let this go on for way too long. This dude is my boyfriend. We are in a serious 3-year relationship. I'm asking you to not call him penis poem guy. I will not do it either. Let's all knock it off.
And that's
that's
like,
it.
That is like a text. That is, it takes exactly as much problems to solve as it took to cause. Like, just like, hey, can we not anymore? The end. There's a maturity problem, and it's kind of, the maturity problem is you, I think, is basically it.
And, like, I don't want to make it sound like I think you are, like, a horrible person, letter
writer. I'm sure you're lovely.
but, you know, like, there's, I really relate to making a joke at somebody else's expense because you are more focused on getting a laugh than on treating somebody else kindly. I've done that in my own life. I did that, especially like at college when I was a younger person. I would often think, what's the funniest thing I can say? Not what's a good and helpful and useful thing to say. So I get it. That's part of growing up and developing into a person, is balancing a sense of humor with a sense of compassion and respecting other people's interiority. That I get. I don't think you should like beat yourself up too much about that. But the 3 years is you got to demonstrate some growth. You got to stop. And you got to, you know,
if it's bothering you, then all you have to say is it's bothering me. That's it.
Yeah.
The problem seems to be that it's not bothering you. To some part of you is not bothered. Some part of you is still laughing. And it's like, if it's a problem, just say, hey, can we not? And that's the end of the, that should be the end of the discussion. I can't imagine a version where it's not.
Yeah. And just take the lead. Just like simply, you know, name it and claim it. As some evangelicals of my acquaintance used to like to say when we were growing up, just say, you know what? I shouldn't have done that. It was unkind. I don't want to do it anymore. You know, you don't have to either beat yourself up or find a way to retroactively justify it. You can just say, I shouldn't have done it. It wasn't kind. I don't want to do it anymore. And that's the appropriate response. And, you know, you will continue to grow and learn and become a kinder, more compassionate person. And that will be great.
Perfect.
Yeah. Now I am thinking of all of the mean stuff that I said when I was in college that I thought was very funny and was not at all funny. It was just mean.
Well,
I would like to go lie down in a cave for the next 7 hours because I just all I'm going to be able to think about. And I was like, mean stuff I said 10 years ago.
To move in the world is to have regrets, right? Like, that's just how it goes. but this one, I think, is a pretty minor one. And it's like, really, it's just you made a cheap joke that person ended up mattering in your life. It happens. It's very easy to address.
Yeah. And I'll just say, my guess is, yeah, I think that you're right, that the reason this is coming up is it may be that you are at a point in your life where you are trying to reassess your own relationship to making jokes because you are trying to figure out how do I make jokes? How do I laugh? How do I have a sense of humor that I don't later feel really guilty about or like I have hurt somebody. And again, I relate to that a lot. That's a big part of becoming a person.
The things I regret most in my life are occasions where I could have been kind and I wasn't, and they don't go away. Like, you have to think about them for a long, long time. And even when you've sought forgiveness for them, it is always a worth building that check into yourself of, is this a kind thing to do or isn't it? Because you can have to live with it for a long time, even when it's something stupid, even if it's something casual.
Yeah. Will this wake me up in 7 years at 3 a.m. and cause me to curl in on myself as I cringe thinking about how funny I thought it was at the time and how bad I feel about it now?
Exactly.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to meet you properly. Next time we really have to have a knockdown drag out war, though, because I feel like we agreed way too much.
I would love it. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling, and our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe now. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops.